when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. Hello and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast all about leaving the EU. The noise you can hear in the background is the noise of business being done in the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce. And the next voice that you'll hear is Alex Davis. Hello, Alex.
Hiya.
And as always, we are also joined by Christian Spence. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
Right, gents, last time we spoke, there was no deal. 2 days later, there is a deal. Did we win? Did we lose? Is it stalemate? How's the land like?
I think broadly, we've gone through before what we expected to happen, and I think we did quite well in our predictions. As things go, in that we've essentially capitulated quite a lot. The EU has given some wiggle room on matters of citizens' rights and things like that, but yes, we have a joint. A joint statement, yeah, of concluding the first phase of talks, which means now it goes to the European Council on the 14th and 15th at the Council Summit, yep. And it's up for them to give the go-ahead for talks to move on to the next phase, which will be on matters of, first of all, transition and withdrawal, and after that, trade.
So, what we've got so far, is this a case as, more or less, as you were? What has changed?
We spoke in the last podcast about the tricky situation that May was in with trying to get this deal done, and I think in truth all that's happened is that many of the major problems that they were facing, we were talking about last week, have simply been kicked down the road, and will still have to be dealt with at a later date. And there's still various stakeholders who are wanting various different things and are unhappy with this agreement for various different reasons. And at some point, there is going to have to be a reconciliation, and May's going to have to deal with some of these groups. So some of the big problems, particularly around how do we get around the Irish border problem, you know, how do we... There is this phrase which MPs are throwing back and forth between each other, of regulatory alignment, you know, which seems to have no real meaning set in stone. But yeah, it's the question of how do we remain aligned to the EU, essentially, in order to avoid a hard border in Ireland, whilst also achieving this kind of regulatory divergence that all the hard Brexiteers want. It's still a question which hasn't been solved in the joint statement, and will have to be dealt with at a later date. I think I'm broadly happy with the fact that we've got this agreement, but some of the comments that we've seen in the recent days have perhaps made the other side not quite so confident that this is what they were expecting.
No, absolutely.
The other side being the Brexiteers, just to be clear.
No, the other side being the EU.
It's in the EU.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, I mean, I think the joint statement as it's been drafted is actually a kind of a very typical EU bureaucratic politician's fudge. It allows both sides to claim some aspect of victory. We explored this, I think, not in the last podcast, but the one before. Well, actually, the EU's perfectly happy to help the tone, if that helps the UK to get into a position it needs to be in. And so there's been a bit of massaging on that. As like I said, the EU has given up quite a bit of some of its asks around citizens' rights, and we've got a decent agreement there. The bill was, they said, it isn't a bill. We talked about this last time. This is what we would have paid anyway. That was always going to be what the EU said it was going to be. We were never going to make any progress there. Northern Ireland has been, as Alex said, it's a can that's been kicked down the road, and we've yet to fall over it. Essentially, that's got to happen at the next stage. But I think, both sides can claim victory so far. But unfortunately, David Davis made some errors on the Andrew Marr show on Sunday morning, which the EU is now kicking back against.
Now, tell me about these errors, because there's quite a lot of politicians who've gone off script since this deal was signed, almost as if they don't know what deal was signed.
Yes, I think what David Davis said on the Marr show, I think what David Davis seems to be doing at the minute is saying whatever needs to be said to the specific audience he's trying to please at the time. So, following the news that the deal was done and the joint statement was completed, many hard Brexiteers got very, very concerned at this idea that we were basically, in the event of no deal or no other arrangement which would maintain the invisible border in Ireland, that we would choose to maintain regulatory alignment in order to avoid that problem. And for many hard Brexiteers, this was kind of a sign that we were putting a nail in the hard Brexit coffin, particularly in the no deal coffin, and we were kind of solidifying the idea that we were going down a soft Brexit route, and so many of them were quite worried about this. And so what David Davis said was that the joint statement was more a statement of intent than anything else, and it isn't legally enforceable, which was, in hindsight, I think even he will agree, a pretty stupid thing to say. At this point where, both sides are meant to have had an agreement, it's still got to be ratified by the European Council. They've still got to give us permission to move on to the next phase of talks. For him to then go on and say, after 8 months of trying to figure this out, we've come up with this joint statement, but you know what, if things don't quite go that way, we can just tear it all up anyway, probably isn't what the other side wanted to hear. And I think some of the things which Guy Verhofstadt,
President of the European Parliament.
Yeah, some of the things which he's said today has basically been, slapping David Davis on the wrist, saying you can't really do that.
Yeah, that's it. So essentially, so all the papers have been drafted really as we speak for the European Council, which sits later this week. One of the items on the agenda is whilst the European Commission has now formally recommended to the Council that sufficient progress has been made, it's up to the Council to decide that, but there's now an amendment been tabled to that by Guy Verhofstadt, which basically says we would only recommend you moving on once the UK statement is enforced into UK law.
Yes, so that's one of the things I was thinking about, actually, which is, has the David Davis gaffe in effect going to force the UK to codify this into law before anything continues?
I'm not sure it would have happened anyway, in the sense that I think they were happy just to try and keep things moving. The problem, we hear this phrase both from Guy Verhofstadt in his statement today, we've heard it from Barnier throughout the entire process, is this concept that trust must be built between the two sides.
Yes.
That we can both believe what the other is saying. Of course, a huge challenge for the UK position, the whole point is there isn't a UK position, this is the problem. The whole challenge is you have May, Davis, Fox, Hammond, and basically everyone else in Parliament talking a different story about what Brexit is, what it might be, why we're doing it, what we want to achieve, what kind of future relationship we want. And of course that is, we have formal negotiations going on, but that's it. As you said with David Davis, he seems to just want to please whoever he's talking to. It's almost like they all talk as if the Europeans aren't listening.
Yes.
So we've just gone through this formal deal, May flew over in the middle of the night, we finally got it over the line, and then the next things the Europeans see is a variety of English cabinet politicians saying the opposite or different things to what is in the agreement. So how do you have trust in your negotiating partner is kind of their question, really.
And I wonder if they're getting it wrong, not necessarily because they're acting in bad faith or they've got their own message put out, although undoubtedly some of that will be going on, but whether just the whole vastness and the complexity of it leads to gaps which politicians are not particularly good at grasping.
I think that's very accurate on the whole.
There was a big conversation going around about after David Davis's comments about whether the deal was legally binding or not. And I think there were some law commentators on Twitter saying that essentially that question is a bit of a red herring, because it's not legally binding in the sense that the EU could take us to court and, you know, get something back because of this. It's not legally binding in that sense, but it is a political agreement. And it was always intended that it would be enforced. And it's this whole thing about trust. So the fact that it's not legally binding isn't really the matter. It's about the fact that we built this trust with the EU and we had come to this conclusion together. It is a joint statement. And then for us to kind of then go say, well, you know, if things don't go exactly in the way that we want them to later on, we can just do something differently anyway, is what's kind of... force them to respond with this, you know, maybe we should enshrine this into law.
Yeah, this goes back to a point we talked about, I think, on the last podcast, which was one of the government's major errors since the very, very beginning of all this is treating an extremely complex problem as if it were simple.
Yes.
And it's handled it very, very bluntly, because it really doesn't... It shows every day that it doesn't understand the complexities and the nuances in all of this, and this just becomes really clear in all this. So we've also had in the last few days Theresa May saying, well, you know, we've agreed the Brexit bill as part of all that, but actually if we don't get a free trade deal, we wouldn't pay it, you know, we'd walk away, we're not bound. It's like, well, again, technically speaking, this agreement doesn't bind you to it, but these are contractual payments the government has signed up to. So if you're going to walk away from them, that is a sovereign default. Now, at a time when the UK is trying to be brave and say we're going to be global Britain, we're going to re-establish ourselves as an independent nation on the global stage, we want to start talking serious trade deals with hundreds and hundreds of countries, all the rest of the world looks back and sees, here's a country which doesn't know what it wants, it says one thing and does another, it's openly saying that if we don't get what we want out of this, we'll go for a unilateral sovereign default. It's not the way to be portraying a nation that actually now needs to start entering into high-level agreements, the sort of which it has not done in nearly five decades.
So I have a thought on this. Traditionally, or not traditionally, but our conventional thought so far is that the EU has the whip hand over the UK from a negotiating point of view, because the EU is this all-powerful body which doesn't have voters to answer to, and they're also rule-bound. So we saw, as soon as Task Force 50 was set up, these are the rules, you can't stray outside the rules. It's very much about interpretation. On the other hand, we've got the UK, which has got all its politicking, and politicians are in charge of Brexit rather than civil servants. And I wonder if this might be one of those situations where we don't appreciate it yet, but the advantage might actually turn into the UK's hand, because the UK can be incredibly flexible. Whereas the EU might ask the UK to put something into law, well, UK politicians are all powerful. They've got much more flexibility than the EU bureaucrats. And I wonder if the flexibility, which has been seen as a downside to the UK negotiating position, is actually going to be seen as a bit of an upside going forward.
I don't think so. No, as a really short answer. Because it's this challenge that the EU has been essentially... the biggest difference, I think, between the EU side... You're right, the EU is a big bureaucratic body. It's, you know, it is the world leader in international trade negotiations, international regulation development. It knew what it wanted from the start. It knew what its red lines were. It hasn't moved from any of those. Now, again, I think in the early stages, the UK would have done better out of all this if it had accepted that. And understood that, actually, because the problem is, it's not that the UK is going to have to give, and it can give because it's flexible, because it's not hide-bound to any of those kind of things.
But it can also take.
The huge challenge it's got is it's spent the last 18 months, 2 years, saying that it's going to go and do options A through Z, when A, it can't do most of those. There was no way on earth the EU was ever going to allow at least half of those. And as we've seen actually with Brexit Bill and with a big chunk of citizens' rights and with the issue of the Northern Ireland border, what the EU stated out to be actually just a clear statement of international law as it currently stands, is how things will work out. I think the challenge on the British side is one of, it's just been, we've managed expectations badly. We promised, the population asked for a moon on the stick. The politicians offered each one of them an individual moon on an individual stick.
Sometimes two or three moons.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, at some point, Theresa May and the government are going to have to turn around and say, do you know what, there's only one moon and there aren't any sticks. And actually, that's how it was always going to be. And this is where, you know, political leadership comes in terms of managing what's actually doable.
Do you think the Brexiteers have been a bit naive? I don't mean in the negotiating position, because I think we know the answer to that. But in terms of criticising and attacking the idea of a soft Brexit, because the whole thing is a process. I mean, to think that they could have a hard Brexit in 2 years is ludicrous. To think they have more than 10 years seems to be perfectly reasonable. They should be getting behind this.
Yeah, I totally agree. We've been saying that right from the start, yeah, that Brexit's going to take 10 years and that's the best way to do it, that's the sensible way to do it. To try and do it in anything less is, is...
Well, it's just setting you up for failure, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not going to work.
It's unforced errors, yes, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's what's constantly coming out of this thing. And I think, in terms of the joint statement, I think it's a fudge to such an extent that I think many of our MPs didn't quite realise what we had signed up to, which I find particularly worrying. I mean, you mentioned before, there's still so many people saying that, you know, if we don't like the arrangements that we make on trade, if we don't like the free trade deal, we can still walk away and not pay anything. But that's not true, because there is a line in the joint statement that nothing is agreed till everything is agreed. But in terms of the Phase 1 joint statement, that's based on only on the Article 50 withdrawal bill, not on the final trade deal. And I think there's basic agreement now that there is no chance whatsoever of us agreeing the free trade deal until we've actually left the EU. And so the next thing that we're going to be talking about in Phase 2 is the withdrawal arrangements and the status quo transition that we're after.
Yeah.
And if we agree those things, then that counts as everything is agreed. And so what I said in the Phase 1 joint statement, is what we've agreed. And I think one of the particularly worrying things, and something which I think is perhaps going to cause a bit of uproar later on, is that that implies to me that we could be paying the bill before we started to talk about the free trade deal.
Oh, certainly, absolutely. Because, I mean, one of the things that came out of the discussions is, and kind of as we expect it to be, we know now that the UK has net liabilities to the EU of 40 billion quid, there or thereabouts. Gross liabilities about 100 billion, net off with all the rest of the assets. We will pay those as they fall due. There is not going to be an invoice that lands on the Treasury's desk in the next few years. So part of that is, so about half of that will be our normal budgetary contributions to the EU spending budget, of which we are a recipient until March 2019. And clearly it looks like, you know, aspects of Horizon 2020 and other projects we're going to be in. So we're going to be receiving funds back. So we pay those in as we pay them now. The longer term liabilities around capital investment, around new projects, around UK EU civil servants pensions, things like that, we pay them as they fall due. So we will be paying this out. Not only will we still be paying it out on the 1st of April 2019, we'll still be paying it out in 2059. Yeah, exactly. So as I said, half this bill will be paid before we've left, essentially, and certainly before the end of the transition period.
And another thing that this means is that once that withdrawal arrangement, the transition period, is agreed, and the way that things are going currently, it's going to be a status quo transition where we are subjected to every commitment that an EU member would be, but without our veto, without our vote, without our say at the table. I mean, that's what we've asked for. And once that is agreed, all of a sudden this joint statement comes into being enforceable. And at which point we have made the commitment then to maintain the invisible border in Ireland. So once we've agreed this transition period, if then we don't like the terms of the free trade agreement, at that point, as far as I understand it, we can no longer have the option of doing no deal, and we still have to maintain the invisible border in Ireland, which means we have to maintain regulatory harmonisation, which means for all intents and purposes we need to kind of stay in the single market and the customs union.
Well, we will be in the single market in all but name. Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Hmm.
And walking away from that would be a breach of international treaty.
Where was I going to go next with this? Now, in a way, do you think everything which has been agreed so far is kind of a bit of a phony one? Because, I mean, when you think about the referendum, which one of these issues featured heavily in any of the debates?
Pretty much none of them.
Not one of them.
In reality. And this has always been the problem.
So we've got Phase 1 out of the way, just. Do you expect fireworks then for Phase 2? Because this is when it's actually going to count as things which are important to people and the overall national debate when it happened.
I think there's some huge problems lined up, and again, I think this is entirely of our own politicians making. And I've been sort of very vocally critical of Theresa May and her red lines. I think increasingly, if you sort of read some of the books coming out now, it's clear that she was probably, it's probably, I've forgotten his name now, Nick Timothy. It's yes. probably him that sits behind the problems we now see. And it's him that essentially struck these incredibly, very, very tough red lines. They came from nowhere. Don't forget, the mandate in the referendum was nothing more than leave the EU. You know, if people want to play what the mandate is, all we know is we want to go. Some people say, well, that meant leaving the single market, it meant leaving the customs union, it meant restricting migration, depending on who you spoke to and which campaign you listened to, you will have heard all and none of the above. So there's no clarity in any of that. Other than, I guess, we know historically the UK population has always had a pretty tense relationship with the EU, and it doesn't particularly like the political ambitions, but it actually rather likes the economic and the trade stuff.
Yeah.
So we don't know anymore. So all of this has to hit a brick wall at some point. So in many ways, like we've seen from David Davis, from Redwood, from Fox, from all of those kind of hard Brexiteers, the entirety of the last 18 months has been the EU saying, we think you owe us about 40 or 50 billion quid, and us saying, we don't owe you a penny legally, you owe us 40 or 50 billion quid, we don't, you know, what was it Boris Johnson said, they can go and whistle,
yep.
The EU saying, you owe us 40 or 50 billion quid, etc, 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 end point, we pay 40 billion quid.
I mean, there's
some stuff here that's immovable. So this challenge around, I think the really big one, I suspect when we get there, will be, we'll still be in the single market post 2019. Mm-hmm. That's guaranteed, essentially, because this can't work out in any other way. So there'll be a huge, the far right Brexiteers on the migration stuff will throw the toys out of the pram there. And then the big one is the Irish border. They said we have committed to a way, Alex said earlier, the default position in this agreement now is, to all intents and purposes, the UK remains a member of the single market and customs union in all but name. There'll be a fudge to make all that happen and make it not look like that, but that will be the outcome. Because it cannot be any other way. The UK government and the EU, absolutely publicly committed, it's there in black and white, there will be no infrastructure at all on the border. Which means we are in the single market and customs union. There is no possible other way of doing
that's
it.
That's a really good... Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I thought when I heard about the frictionless, the open, the invisible, whatever the border is now going to call
it. Can't be done. That's it. And politicians are wading into this and talking about the wrong terminology. So everyone's saying we've got to remain in the customs union to make the border visible. It's not the customs union which makes the border invisible. It's common regulator. What about freedom of movement? All that sort of freedom of movement is not about getting across a border without showing a passport. That's what Schengen does. And neither Ireland nor the UK are members of Schengen. That's about rights to settle. It's a different thing. So the problem is we've still got, this was forgivable. Actually, it wasn't forgivable the day after the referendum. It was forgivable at the time of the Bloomberg speech that our politicians had basically zero knowledge about any of this term. Halfway through the Article 50 process, it is completely unforgivable that it appears that not one of our politicians knows how to use these words and actually knows what the meaning of these terms is. That's really unforgivable. Because it's that whole thing, I think I talked in a very early episode, but they say we want Parliament to have a meaningful vote. Parliament can't have a meaningful vote because Parliament has shown repeatedly it doesn't know what it's talking about. So you can have a vote to stay or go or like the agreement or not like it. Nobody in the House of Commons, certainly we've yet to see what the Lords will do to the withdrawal bill when it hits there. No one in the Commons can do this.
Does the invisible border kind of tell us exactly what the trade deal will be? I mean, we don't really need to know much more about it, do we? Both sides sit down, they start talking about trade, and someone says, oh, what about the border? Okay, as you were.
Well, I think this is another problem, is that a free trade deal won't allow for an invisible border.
It can't do, can it?
No, free trade deals don't. There's a lovely phrase, Alex, to interrupt, but someone said, the distance between WTO terms and a free trade agreement is probably only 5% of the difference between a comprehensive free trade agreement and single market and customs union.
Yeah.
The distance is immeasurable. An FTA is just a bolt onto WTO terms. It's not anything revolutionary.
Yeah, so we can use the analogy of David Davis saying that we would, another brilliant promise from David Davis, that we would sign a CETA plus deal within minutes after leaving the EU in 2019.
Okay.
And so the whole debate is now starting to be framed as in a fight between the CETA route and something like the Norway route.
And really what it comes down to is this idea of regulatory alignment or regulatory divergence. So do we want to continue to align ourselves as much as possible to the EU, or do we want to diverge and perhaps align ourselves towards something more like the USA or Canada? And it's two completely different routes, and you can't really do both at the same time. And so David Davis is saying that we can do this Canada-style CETA plus deal, where we can take the CETA agreement and bolt on loads of new things, you know, which allow for better trade and services and things like that. But it's simply not possible. I mean, as Christian just said, a free trade agreement does nothing to allow an invisible border. The key element that you need for an invisible border is total regulatory harmonisation of both laws and the mechanisms by which you enforce those laws. CETA doesn't do any of that. And one of the big things that's missing from CETA is much in terms of improving trade terms of services. Now, we know that the single market isn't brilliant in terms of services trade. But one of the key things that these big modern FTAs include is most favoured nation clauses, and I think we've touched upon these before.
We have, but just remind us.
So,
actually, basic what an MFN concept is first, probably.
So most favoured. Oh god, you've put me on the spot there. So once we leave the EU, we're going to become essentially a third country from the EU's perspective. But because of our status as a big trading country, we are subjected to WTO most favoured nation rules,
okay.
Which it means that we cannot give trade concessions to one country without also giving them to another country. So we can't play favourites, basically. Right. I think
that's it.
No, that's putting it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So yeah, if whatever your best, we can't say we're not going to have any tariffs with the EU, but we will levy them on everywhere else. We can't do that unilaterally. The only way you can do that is through a WTO registered free trade agreement.
Yes.
Which has to take into account the substantial majority of trade flows between those two blocks. So also when David Davis has said, we'll exempt tariffs on cars from Germany. You can't do anything from Germany because Germany's part of the EU Customs Union and Common Commercial Policy. B, you cannot do it on just cars. It's not allowed under international law. That's not something either the UK or the EU has the power to deliver.
Yeah, so the two most recent big FTAs that the EU did were with Canada, the CETA deal,
yep.
And also with South Korea. And both of these deals have MFN, Most Favoured Nation clauses, on them in terms of services, which mean that if the EU were to do a free trade agreement with us that gave considerably more concessions on trade and services than did the CETA or the South Korea deal, then those two deals would then have to be readjusted to give Canada and South Korea the same access.
Yeah. Got you.
And another interesting point to make on that is that there are get-out clauses in those MFN clauses which allow countries like Switzerland and Norway to do their own trade deals which better those terms through a body like EFTA.
So why isn't Norway affected by most favoured nation status when it does its own trade deals?
Essentially because written into the... first of all, not all the free trade deals have MFN clauses,
yeah.
And the MFN clauses don't apply to every part of the trade deal. So CETA and the South Korea one in particular have MFN clauses on services, but there is an exemption for countries like Switzerland and Norway who are doing their own free trade deals through the free trade body EFTA. So EFTA can go and negotiate a free trade deal which does more on services than the CETA or the South Korea deal will, and those two deals do not have to be readjusted if Norway or Switzerland wanted to do so.
Right.
So, I mean, again, we're getting brought back to this whole EEA-EFTA. And the two things are becoming separate now. We're not talking so much in terms of the Norway option. People are talking about the EEA as a route to keeping us in the single market. The conversation around us staying in EFTA seems to have died down. EFTA's being seen as a bit of a bolt-on option.
Mm-hmm.
But I think me and Christian would probably agree that it's a good bolt-on option.
Yeah, it gives you maximum flexibility. And the thing is, the challenges that some people make about, you know, having rules imposed, we've discussed before that that's not entirely true. There's an aspect of truth to it,
mm-hmm.
but it's certainly not entirely true. So it's reasonable for people to say it's not an ideal option. It's not in that sense. But the point is for us is it's considerably more ideal than the route the government is currently taking. That's the point.
Just as a thought experiment here, just so I understand that. We get our trade deal, and it basically is exactly the same as what we currently have. I mean, we don't make the laws, we don't make the rules anymore. But for all intents and purposes, it's the same thing. if we stop manufacturing widgets to standard A and then start manufacturing standard B outside the rules of the EU, what happens? Presumably we get taken to a court somewhere?
It would depend what was in the agreement as to how that's enforced, but it would certainly spring border checks immediately, because essentially there's now a risk of non-EU standard products entering the market. Yeah.
So that, what would they do in relation to Northern Ireland? They couldn't just wheel out some borders. I mean, it's going to have to be...
Well, this is the whole challenge, see, where we have, and again, we had John Redwood on his usual idiot box over the weekend, saying that, you know, it's why would the EU want to put any borders up? The EU will be required under international law, its current legal obligations and WTO rules to erect that border.
But again,
once essentially you've got the border, which is no longer in the customs union, this is the issue here, the regulator, it's not the customs, the single market. Essentially, it has to erect a border. It has to protect its own legal integrity, because otherwise, it's a route for smuggling. And then once there's the risk of substantial goods coming in to the single market, essentially, it's not about. The EU doesn't want to see it because it reduces the integrity. Other nations don't want to see it because we'll say, hang on, if it's easier for the UK to smuggle goods without due to the appropriate checks into the UK than it is the US, for example, then the EU is essentially giving preferential treatment. And you would be in trade disputes at a WTO level between the US and the EU.
I don't want to see an international trade dispute, but I would love to see this in action, just to see actually what everyone did. Because you've got the conflict between the Irish really not wanting a border. You know,
that's it. I mean, this is all the thing. These things are sort of irresolvable because they're mutually exclusive. The problem is the asks are mutually exclusive.
Now, from a Chamber point of view, have you had any feedback from your members? Are they happy with this? Are they? You know, is there any positive, negative feedback? Or do they just simply not care? Are they waiting for the big stuff?
I'd say the latter. I wouldn't say they don't care, but it's the big stuff. Because essentially, this is the agreement last week was a big political statement, but actually, practically nothing has changed. So, you know, lots of people were saying, you know, in fact, the government was tweeting heavily saying, look, we've now guaranteed citizens' rights. At the same time as David Davis is saying, well, actually, to be honest, we can tear this up whenever we like. So, actually, citizens' rights are not yet guaranteed. The two sides have reached an agreement to implement this, providing stage two is agreed. So there is still no certainty over citizens' position. There is still no certainty about what the world will look like for UK businesses on the 29th of March 2019. We know no more. We know it's less likely that it's going to be a horrendous outcome, because essentially we've committed to, you know, the default position. Our default fallback, theoretically now, is essentially single market and customs union membership. But we don't have confirmation of that.
Yes.
That's the thing. So until there's something black and white which says at midnight on the 29th of March 2019, the world will look like this, and the this is identical to what it looked like now, business will not relax.
So what is the next step for Brexit? The 27 are meeting to ratify this, and then we're going to start free trade. No, we're going to start transition talks.
We're going to start transition talks. That's the next bit, Alex, I think.
Yes, so it's the EU Council Summit on the 14th and 15th.
This week, Thursday, Friday this week.
Thursday, Friday, where the Council will hopefully give us permission to move on to the next phase of talks. A general misconception is that we will quickly be moving on to the matters of trade, but we will mostly be talking about what happens on March 2019. How do we get this status quo transition? What does that look like? Only once that is sorted will we start to move on to talk about what the future trading arrangement will look like. We can't sign any of that off or do any deals in that respect until we've actually left.
Yeah. And this is really hard. The transition is hard. Because we're asking for something very... I mean, from my point of view, I would say we're asking for something very, very odd. We're saying we want to stay in with all of the obligations, but take away all the benefits of representation. that's actually the UK's position. We continue to abide by all the rules, but we walk away from the tables where we can influence them. That's a very, so we're voluntarily putting ourselves in what they might call the EA position.
It's also a completely unprecedented position.
It's unprecedented legally, and there are big questions about how achievable this is.
Writing the legal text which allows us to basically be a member of the EU without being a member of the EU is going to be something which no one has ever thought
No one has ever done, because presumably this will include all of the third country trade deals the EU already has as part of its common commercial policy. The question for me around how the EU handles this is it has to somehow square the circle of offering a third country full-blown single market customs union and common commercial policy access and not offering it to the rest. That is a breach of MFN that we just talked about. Unless it's a full comprehensive deal. So there's going to have to be, there's some serious legal jiggery. Now, you know, if anyone can make it work, it's the EU. But there's going to have to be some very crafty obfuscation about how you actually pull this off. Because in many ways, the easiest way of doing what we're trying to do is to say, we just extend Article 50, we leave in 2021 rather than 2019. Except, unfortunately, it still doesn't get you around the point that we cannot begin trade talks with the EU until we've left.
And I guess from a gradual Brexiteer point of view, you're going to have to go through a stage of taking rules, not making rules, until you can get to that stage of actually, you know, what they really want.
That's it. And I think you talked earlier about fireworks. I mean, I think one of the, I mean, the EU, mostly new EU laws and regs move pretty slowly by the nature of the organisation. But it's plausible that after we leave and we move into transition period, the EU starts to enact new laws and regulations which will need to hit the statute books before the end of the transition period. And I can see a huge fireworks in the Brexit side.
Anything when to essentially, banking, city, services.
When the UK government will be obliged to, because don't forget, the current plan is we'll have the EU withdrawal bill on statute before March 2019. In fact, it has to be, or else chaos really will reign. Although maybe it won't, because if we are, that might get handled by the EU legislative side rather than our own. But apparently, if we're repealing the European Communities Act, then we remove all the framework which allows that to happen. Is that during that transition period, new laws and regulations will appear, which means we'll have to keep transposing those over manually as they come. And you can just see some Brexiteers doing a bit of a nut, saying, I thought we'd left, why are we still having to implement all of this?
Well, this is going to go on for the next 10 years now.
Yeah.
This is the new world. Yeah, that's quite exciting. Right, anyone want to add anything else? Anything that you want to...
I think that's probably the substantive stuff for now. I mean, I think it's really... Oh, yeah.
Just one last point of order. Yes, we're going to do the transition period. We spoke about that. Are there any other bits and pieces that we've completely overlooked? So, in the first place, we had citizens' rights and the border, so on and so forth. Is it simply just a transition phase that we're doing?
It's transition phase first, and it'll be... I mean, don't forget, first of all, we need the EU... The European Commission has not yet formally agreed to the concept of the transition. It's not yet clear whether that will pop out of this council or whether we need to wait for the next one. I think the recommendations are we move to talk to transition. The Commission has certainly not decided that it wants... that it's ready to talk about future trade, and the expectations are it's going to be the March or the April European Council summit before... that is actually the next one after this, so we're some way away from talking about all that. I think the one to watch is probably the Irish border stuff as that rattles on, because the Ireland is quite correctly extremely worried about this. The Ireland is the only country in the EU which would do worse out of a bad Brexit than the UK, quite substantially worse than the UK, primarily because even though it's, whilst you know, bulk of it, the majority of its trade actually is with the UK itself, pretty much all of the trade to the rest of the EU27 transits the UK. So it's got some big issues there, because at the moment most of its trade comes in through Holyhead, Stranraer, and then down and out through Dover. So it's got all of that side to handle. And what is clear is the EU will not rush Ireland. If Ireland's not happy, the EU will stay in lockjaw. Then, of course, you've got the domestic political pressure of Theresa May and the DUP, because the DUP say they want everyone out of the single market and the customs union, that the integrity of the UK single market should not be undermined, But those things are, again, you know, and the border must be kept open. All of those are mutually incompatible.
Yep.
And you know, and I think for the government's point of view, it's still got in this idea that, you know, if some technical solution cannot be found in an FTA to reduce the border, well, the truth is, we know the answer to that question. There is no solution which will make that border go away in an FTA agreement. So it needs to square the circle. And I just wonder how quickly over the coming negotiations that brick wall will become apparent in UK politics.
Another thing which is going to have to be discussed, I think I'm correct in this, in that the amendment to the withdrawal bill on the parliamentary vote on the final deal mm-hmm. is being voted upon tomorrow.
It is, yes, it's back in the House this week.
So there's going to be some news about that coming tomorrow, and in my eyes, I still have no idea what that means or what they will be voting on.
No, it's questionable if it has any meaning at all.
There seems to be this impression that it's going to be a vote on the final deal, but if that vote's going to happen before March 2019, we know that it can't include the free trade agreement. And so is that vote just going to be on the terms of the transition deal? You know, it's very hard to work out what that vote's going to be for, what it could achieve, whether it's going to be meaningful, whether Parliament, you know, even has the expertise to give it a good go.
Yeah.
None of that is particularly clear in my head. And also, there was an interesting quote I saw from Jeremy Corbyn today. After last week, we spoke about the fact that it seemed as if Keir Starmer was softening up Labour's Brexit position. Apparently, Jeremy Corbyn has said that they've done a good job of capturing some of the Remain and some of the Leave vote, and at this point, they don't want to strengthen up their Brexit position at all in case they alienate a particular group.
He said that.
Yeah. So it seems as if Labour is still gonna, you know, play the quiet game and stay away from things as much as possible, and just let the Tories destroy themselves. That seems to be their current.
Which actually, from a sheer political point of view, he's probably the right card to play.
I disagree strongly, actually. I think people have been quite surprised that we managed, because remember, from a bystander's point of view, the whole Brexit thing looks like a mess. You've got the Brexiteers making a hell of a noise that it's not the Brexit that we wanted. You've got the Remainers saying, you know, we're all going to die suddenly next March, and you know, everyone in between is saying, you know, like we have today, that David Davis doesn't have a clue, and that all kind of bears out. Yet somehow they've managed to conclude the first round of talks, and I have a feeling that if they manage to conclude the second round and actually exit the EU without any blood being spilt, that's going to be a massive, massive coup. And if Labour haven't addressed that, what good arguments of why what they've done is wrong or right or an alternative, it's going to backfire enormously.
I think there's a longer term game. So the challenge is what we will know. You know, what we'll know, presumably by, you know, end of 2018, early 2019, is we'll have a transition period agreed. Mm. We know that from the EU's point of view, there are two things that must be. Number one is it's standstill. Mm. They've said it's standstill or act. So there's no picking and choosing. It's the whole acquis. And it will be time limited. So the agreement signed will say you exit your standstill position probably in either end of 20 to end of calendar year 2020, which is their budgeting cycle, or March 2021. The problem you've got is we then have 2 years to negotiate the future agreement. In this way, some of the hard Brexiteers that I've sort of challenged and said they're wrong. Again, it's one of those great aspects where they're wrong but partially right. How easy would it be for the UK and the EU to agree a zero tariff FTA on goods? Actually, really straightforward. The problem is that's nowhere near enough.
Mm.
That will be devastating. If not inside the customs union, outside of single market regulatory alignment, outside of phytosanitary and agriculture stuff, that will be catastrophic. It's not sufficient. But that's your kind of best case default scenario. So the challenge for Labour, of course, is Labour's position, the position of its members and its parliamentary party is more split over this than any of the other parties. It's got a chunk of it, its old-fashioned core membership is heavily pro-Brexit.
Mm.
Its parliamentary party is heavily Remain in sort of in totality, actually don't leave at all, never mind about what it is you want to do. But actually, a huge chunk of the pro-leave side of Labour is also trying to square it with the unions, who actually quite like the employment regulation and all of that kind of side of the EU. So there's a horrible, horrible tension. So the problem is, as soon as they come out on one side or the other, they sort of skewer everything. Where actually, if you can get, if you can get to the point where, look, the only default outcome now is chaos, we are now going to have to take you down this path to solve the short term, that might give them a political advantage.
I guess all the things that you're talking about there are talking to their existing membership, and that's what they, I mean, that's what they do anyway. I mean, they're in a state of a very quiet state of civil war, but nevertheless, it is there. Talking to the population as a whole, if and this is a big if, the Tory party managed to somehow get, for instance, a soft Brexit where everything looks the same as it did before the vote, I actually think that they do okay.
Yeah, we shall have to see. I think the big one for me is, remember, we had this huge deadline of March 2019 by which we had to do something. We expect the next 2, 3, 4 months will bring forward the transition agreement. All that does is kick the cliff edge to 2021. It doesn't.
Yeah.
Nothing else has been solved. All you've done is put it off. All of the same problems still exist.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
All it does is buy time. It doesn't provide a solution.
I just like the visuals of Theresa May trying to sort things out in Brussels and Jeremy Corbyn going to a Friends of Cuba rally, and then you think, who is fit? Fits for this country.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but the level pegging in the polls.
Theresa May's ahead.
Within a margin of error, yes.
I just want to point out that was not a direct quote from Jeremy Corbyn. It was what the Guardian inferred from talking to his team.
I was going to say, it didn't sound like a very Jeremy Corbyn quote.
Yeah, I was questioning that as I was saying. I knew that I'd seen it somewhere. One thing that I just wanted to raise was, last week we were speaking about Theresa May and how her position looked completely untenable and that something big was going to happen. And then this deal just got completely fudged, and now that seems to have just gone again.
I think it probably has for now. There's no one else lined up. I know there's some talk about, you know, David Davis's team coming along to decapitate Theresa May and take over, but I don't think he has any credibility with the party more generally, certainly, to do that. No, so I think she's safe for now, but I think the problem is it's a for now. It's that thing, because people, you know, lots of people are taking lots of comfort from phase one. But it's mostly a political fudge. The financial deal was always going to end up where it was. Citizens' rights, fuck good, we finally got there and we agreed. But the big difficult stuff still hasn't been answered. So, yeah.
Well, the Brexiteer wing of the Tory party is public enemy number one. I mean, you could look at Gove and say he's slightly being rehabilitated because he says nice things about plastic, but generally speaking, they are public enemy number one.
Mm-hmm.
I think Theresa May hangs on purely because Jeremy Corbyn is her biggest ally and her biggest asset. And it will go to the next election, and if Labour haven't got a different candidate, I imagine everything will be pretty much the status quo.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot going to happen yet. We've got to get the transition deal through. And I said there are some legal challenges, never mind political challenges, to doing that. If clarity is, we're going to start seeing, we've already seen, you know, some companies are already relocating, we are going to start seeing a lot more of those in the first quarter of next year. This stuff might start to change opinion. You know, at some point, one of the big guys will do a big move of supply chain relocation or something like that, and that might, you know, it's very hard to predict how the public will respond to
like
that.
Like a Nissan Sunderland or something.
Yeah, I can't see any of the big guys in that sort of scale relocating the entire plans, because there's massive capital sunk, so you would exhaust the capital before anything else. And you know, the customs issues are clearly going to be a 2021 problem rather than a 2019, we assume at the moment. But I do wonder, and it is when, it's not if, when the first big high profile kind of shift happens, because at the moment they're mostly being batted away because they're relatively small fry. It's companies just spinning up subsidiaries, moving 100 staff, you know, you can sort of get away with that. But if there's a big employer in a town which takes a hit, then, you know, who knows? When we see, you know, you see around the financial crisis, around some of the euro crisis, it's very hard to work out how public reaction goes with these things. Sometimes it swallows it and doesn't blink. Sometimes it's a huge uprising, and you can never really predict.
Right, we will actually leave it there. Before we do, any chamber news?
our quarterly economic breakfast on Friday. I'm currently working on all of our forecasts and updated status of the GM economy. That's the big thing. And then actually I finish for Christmas. So for me, it's all eyes on Friday afternoon.
Oh, excellent. Oh, so no podcast next,
well,
next
week? Well, you can do a podcast, but you haven't got me.
Excellent. And where can we find you gents on social media?
I'm at @GMCC_Alex.
And I'm at @GMCC_Christian.
And if you'd ever be interested, @JBeardmore. So until not next week, but maybe the week after that, enjoy Brexit. Merry Brexit, everyone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.